thinking about abortion, usually people say there are only two sides, right?
Usually the first one, pro-life or anti-abortion, the general conclusion, right, is that life begins at fertilization. And there's some other things that may go into anti-abortion politics too. Some people think that abortion, you know, is a betrayal of women's role, but people didn't really think about it at the time so much as a question of what, you know, letting women decide when they wanted to become moms. It was much more about the government caring about weeding out people they didn't want to be financially responsible for.
Hi everyone, welcome back to Taboo Tuesday. Hari ini kita akan ngomongin tentang abortion dengan best friendku yang udah gue kenal selama 26 tahun. But here's the deal, she's American. So this entire thing will probably be in English. Mungkin aku akan klarifikasi sana-sini pakai bahasa Indonesia. But we're actually going to talk with my best friend Mary, who's actually an expert when it comes to the topic of abortion, which will make you all wonder, what? So, hi Mary, how are you? Can you introduce yourself, your background, and how come you know so much about abortion laws?
Sure, yeah. So I'm Gita's best friend, which is probably the most important thing. We met in high school, so we've been friends for a long time. I'm a legal historian. I work now at a law school in Florida. I'm gonna be visiting at Harvard Law School in the spring and probably going somewhere else after that. I've written a bunch of books on it. And I guess how I got started was sort of a funny story, because I was in law school at Harvard and we were doing a class on something, you know, people listening to this show might think a lot about, which is sort of, if you want to change the world, how do you do it? And what role does law play in that? And we kept reading about, you know, desegregation and racial justice, which was great. And I as a little, you know, young feminist was sort of like, okay, when are we going to read about Roe v. Wade? And then the semester ended and we didn't read about Roe v. Wade. And I went to my professor and was like, yo, you know, where's the Roe v. Wade book? And he said, there is no Roe v. Wade book. And so I, at age 27, thought, well, then I'll write that book. And that was what got me started. And, you know, I was kind of naive, but I've now written lots of books about it, but it was a lot more work than I originally thought. So it actually started more just as a question of social change for me, even than about abortion, even though I got interested in both later on.
Wait, so you wrote the first book on Roe v. Wade?
I wouldn't say like the first book on Roe v. Wade, more the first book on what do you learn about how you change the world from the aftermath of Roe v. Wade. I'm probably known as, or have been called multiple times, the best historian of the post-Roe era. So people had written about how you get to Roe, but no one had figured out what happened next, right? Which obviously is important for any country that's thinking about changing its abortion rules. Like, if you legalize it, then what happens after that? And that was what interested me.
Okay, got it. Now, for people who don't know what Roe is, what is Roe? You keep saying Roe v. Wade. What is that?
So Roe v. Wade, it was a U.S. Supreme Court that not only legalized abortion across the United States, but held that abortion was a fundamental constitutional right. So, and that it was a right to privacy, essentially that it was related to self-determination and everything from using birth control to deciding to get married or whom to marry, to deciding to have kids or not to have kids. There was this sort of network of decisions you made, really important personal decisions, and that abortion fell in that category. And ever since then, Roe's been important in US law, but also kind of across the world as a touchstone of debate. When other countries are figuring out what they want their abortion policies to look like, they look at the United States and see if that's an example they want to follow or not.
Got it. Okay, so when we're thinking about abortion, usually people say there are only two sides, right? Can you explain more about what these two sides are and how are they in the US?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably wrong to say there are only two sides, but the two sides, to the extent there are two sides, right, there's, you'd say like pro-life or anti-abortion or pro-choice or pro-abortion rights. So usually the first one, pro-life or anti-abortion, the general conclusion, right, is that life begins at fertilization.
Yes, life begins at, yeah. Masukani.
Right. So yeah, life begins at fertilization, and that means that abortion is murder, basically, and that abortion is itself, you know, a violation of human rights. And there's some other things that may go into anti-abortion politics too. Some people think that abortion, you know, is a betrayal of women's role in the home. You know, if you're thinking about cisgender women in particular, or, you know, it undermines the traditional family. The pro-choice or abortion rights side, basically the idea is that abortion is an issue of autonomy for women, equality for women, dignity for women, kind of related to things like people messing with your body, like forcibly medicating you or sexually assaulting you, related to consent. The thing is, there also in the United States, there's, I would say actually most people are somewhere in between those two positions. They tend to think, and actually that's true in Europe and lots of the world too, including parts of Asia, where people would think abortion should be legal, and then legal later only in cases like threats to health or conditions incompatible with life. But that's not what politics do in the US. So as often, right, like in most parts of the world, what our politicians do and what our law says don't always reflect what people want.
So what do people want?
It's kind of messy, right? I mean, I think in the US and in Europe and a lot of parts of the world, people want abortion to be legal, but they're not always comfortable with it for themselves. And if they're having abortions, they may feel relief about it, but also experience complicated emotions about it. And one of the things that's kind of messy about that is it makes it really hard, whether you're in Asia or the United States, to talk about how real people experience abortion, right? Because it's not black and white. It's a lot of people even who think it's great have complicated reactions to it. And a lot of people who think it should be legal but restricted, things like that that are not really fitting into this sort of pro-choice, pro-life paradigm that has been, I think, it not only in the US, but in a lot of parts of the world.
Mary, I'm a big fan of like the Netflix show called Sex Education. And I think a part of this particular show that talks a lot about sex, a lot about abortion, a lot about relationships with people is it's done in a very westernized context. Right. Do you personally feel that abortion in Asian context, like in Asian culture, is very different? Do you have an opinion about this?
Can be, right? I mean, I think it depends on the country. So I would say generally the first answer is yes, but less so over time. So, I mean, if you take South Korea as an example, South Korea's Supreme Court just legalized a lot of abortions just a few years ago. And response to the decision to me felt more Western than I was used to seeing in debate in South Korea about abortion, right? So you had a lot of what looked kind of like religious pro-life groups who were opposed to the decision. And so some of this is just that these movements, right, the pro-choice and pro-life movements have become international and they're in Asia too. So that said, they're doing this against a very different background. And of course in Asia, right, like you can't, I don't think, really talk about abortion in Asia, even in a coherent way, because, you know, what abortion looks like in Indonesia is very different than what abortion looks like in South Korea, which is very different than what it looks like in China or India, right? So in China or India, we're having debates about things like, you know, should there be a ban on sex selection abortion because ratios, you know, that's not really a debate you're having with the same force in parts of Southeast Asia. Some places are places where abortion's been legal for a while, but people are debating whether the reasons for it make sense, whether it's been legal for the wrong reasons, like for state control or eugenic reasons rather than feminist reasons. In other parts of Asia, you're talking about, you know, whether anyone should be able to have abortions, which is sort of what's happening more in Indonesia. So the context is definitely different from the West, but that's changing, I think, some over time because, and this is a combination of social movement stuff and, you know, church stuff, that a lot of the arguments that are made in the US are getting exported, you know, to Asia, to Africa, to South America. So some of this sort of, you know, including through social media, right? So the differences, I think, are shrinking and probably not in super productive ways.
Got it. Well, when you said for feminist reasons, what do you mean by a feminist reason?
Yeah, so I think when abortion laws were first reformed in Japan, it was often with an eye to kind of eliminating what people saw as genetically undesirable people, right? And there were eugenic laws like this across the world, right? It was common in the West as well as in parts of Asia, but people didn't really think about it at the time so much as a question of what, you know, letting women decide when they wanted to become moms. It was much more about the government caring about weeding out people they didn't want to be financially responsible for. So in some parts of Asia, and that's true sometimes of, you know, sex ratio laws too, some people, some activists in Asia want abortion to be legal, but are worried that the people performing abortions or the government officials who signed off on abortion being legal are not thinking about women's freedom when they're doing it, right?
Really quickly, so one of the things that keeps coming up, let's say in the Asian context, there is a lot of question about the definition of human life according to religion. So what are your thoughts about if we define human life according to religion? Because for example, in some countries, let's say Indonesia, there are a lot of people with Muslim religion and any other type of religion who feel very strongly about the way they define human life.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard. I think, I mean, first of all, there's the sort of question of when life begins and then what you do about it. I think it's hard in a country like Indonesia that's religiously diverse, right, where people have different views about when life begins, to have a single legal solution that reflects one religious view, because that's naturally going to cause conflict, right? Because then you're going to be pissing off a lot of people who don't share that religious view. And then I think the other question is just kind of one that relates to, like, in the United States, right, for a while, we actually criminalized alcohol, right? Like, you couldn't use alcohol. And there are decent arguments for that. It was, you know, people were beating their wives, people were spending all their money and not, like, saving up for their kids. But, you know, it basically totally didn't work, right? So I think there's also the question of, if you don't think this thing is a good idea, should you criminalize it? Because is that actually going to work? Or is that going to do something like put a lot of people in prison, see a lot of people killing themselves inadvertently through illegal procedures? So I think if it's a religious question, then I think it really becomes a matter of, you know, what do you do about that? If you think life begins at fertilization, how do you encourage people to carry pregnancies to term? And I think historically, criminalizing a behavior isn't the most effective way to stop people from doing it.
And I think that's what makes, like, this issue so nuanced, because technically anyone from any kind of political background or religious background can kind of put their own meaning to things, like what is life, what is morality, what is right, what is wrong. And it's really interesting what you said, Mary, like, it really depends on what your religious beliefs are like, and then it can differ. And also another thing that I see, like, right now that is a big contradiction, especially in America. You know how the main argument that I keep hearing about people rejecting vaccines is, like, I should have autonomy on my body, like, but then for some reason for abortion, it becomes kind of like this bipartisan issue as well, whereby the people that actually had that belief for autonomy over their own body being vaccinated are actually the one that are going against the autonomy for women over their bodies. Like, where do you see these kind of nuances in society?
I mean, I think people are totally capable of contradicting themselves about this. I mean, their argument essentially would be that, you know, with vaccines, there's only your body involved, which, I mean, is also not true, right? Because you're getting COVID and then giving it to other people. So the idea that it's just you is, like, BS. But what they're trying to say is, with abortion, you know, you are killing another human being. But of course, that's true with vaccines too. So it's just an instance where, you know, people are often comfortable with choice or freedom for themselves and not necessarily for people they disagree with.
Yes, correct.
So funny.
That is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, people are, it's kind of dismaying in the US. I mean, part of the other problem, I think, and this is true in the US, but it's not just true in the US, is that people, like, inhabit different factual universes, right?
Yes.
So when people are thinking about, okay, what is abortion? And it's probably true in Asia too. People are probably, if you're conservative or progressive or whatever, you're probably reading different things online. You probably have a different community on social media. If you're in the US, you're watching a different TV channel or a different YouTube stream. Like, you're not seeing the same facts as other people. So you may, you know, really believe vaccines don't work, and you may, which is disturbing because it makes it even harder to get to some kind of common sense conversation about this stuff, because people are living in completely alternative universes, right? Which is pretty scary, but I think I've seen that a lot in the US and elsewhere.
Wow. Do you think, like, science can finally, like, catch up to actually answer these kind of philosophical questions about when life begins, and can they feel something, or or is it enough to just kind of discuss extensively over and over again?
I don't think science can. I don't think, I'm not hopeful about that, because science in so many places has become politicized, right? And you can look no further than the pandemic to see that. But it's true. It's definitely true with abortion too. So in the US, for example, and this is true elsewhere too, people are fighting about, you know, does abortion increase the risk of breast cancer? Does it cause something like PTSD? All these questions that science pretty definitively says no, right? But that doesn't matter, because then what happens is that people who are opposed to abortion will say, you know, the reason scientists are saying that is because they're pro-choice. Because they're biased, right? It's like the media is biased, science is biased. No one is fair to conservatives. So that's kind of where we are. I think if there's any hope, it's that when you actually drill down into poll data and what people actually think, what people think is pretty sensible and pretty nuanced. It's the politics that are messed up, right? So there's a disconnect in most places between, because if you let people, you know, actually, like what happened in Ireland is a hopeful example, right? In Ireland, they went to just normal people and they gave them a referendum. And they're just like, what do you want to do about abortion? Figure it out. And they passed something that's pretty popular that reflects what most people there think. And it's gone pretty well. But in a lot of countries, you know, even democracies, they're representative democracies, right? People aren't voting themselves. It's politicians doing it. And politicians are going to cater to the people who care the most. Those tend to be like religious groups. They tend to be social movement activists who don't, you know, want to compromise or who don't want to think about, you know, things in a different way sometimes. And I think that's part of why things are so messed up.
That is really cool to learn.
So then that means like herein the problem could lie in the political system itself then, and the way representatives are being appointed and the kind of double agendas that they may have.
Money too. I mean, this is like an industry in a lot of countries, and I'm sure it's true in Asia too, because you have a lot of politicians who raise a lot of money talking about abortion, right? Because it feelings run high. And that's definitely true in the US. There are people who've made careers out of this. Right? Lobbyists, politicians, it's a huge money industry.
Andrea, you said you have some information on the Indonesian abortion laws?
Yeah, I'm just going to talk about it in Indonesian. Jadi, gimana sih hukum aborsi di Indonesia? Hukum aborsi di Indonesia, I'm quoting from hellosehat.com. Jadi, diatur dalam Undang-Undang nomor 36 tahun 2009 tentang kesehatan dan peraturan pemerintah nomor 61 tahun 2014 tentang kesehatan reproduksi. Aborsi di Indonesia tidak diizinkan kecuali untuk situasi kedaruratan medis yang mengancam nyawa ibu dan atau janin serta bagi korban perkosaan. Menggugurkan kandungan dengan alasan keselamatan medis hanya dapat dilakukan setelah mendapatkan persetujuan dari ibu hamil dan pasangannya, kecuali bagi korban perkosaan, dan penyedia layanan kesehatan bersertifikat, serta melalui konseling dan atau konsultasi pratindakan yang dilakukan oleh konselor yang kompeten dan berwenang. Segala jenis praktek aborsi yang tidak termasuk dalam ketentuan undang-undang di atas merupakan aborsi ilegal. Dan sanksi pidana bagi aborsi ilegal diatur dalam pasal 194 Undang-Undang Kesehatan yang menetapkan hukuman pidana penjara paling lama 10 tahun dan denda paling banyak 1 miliar rupiah. Pasal ini dapat menjerat oknum dokter dan atau tenaga kesehatan yang dengan sengaja melakukan aborsi ilegal maupun pihak perempuannya sebagai pasien.
Thank you. Basically, what it is in Indonesia, abortion is not legal. It's not legalized unless in cases of medical emergencies and also in cases of rape. And there are certain cases that they would consider, but overall, it is not a legal practice.
Do you know, so in a lot of countries, when that's the rule, the reality on the ground is basically...
so high.
It's the money. Basically, that's what it turns into. So people with money can find a way to make it look like they have a health emergency or they've been raped or whatever. They basically know the doctors, they know the right things to say, and then low income people don't, right? So that it tends to be not that when abortion is illegal in your country, that abortion is actually not happening in your country. It tends to be more it's happening, and whether it's happening at the doctor's office or, you know, in somebody's like apartment, depends on how much money that person has. Is that, I would assume that's true.
No, that's absolutely correct. Because I'm looking at an article that was written by the Jakarta Post, is that what is happening on the ground is there's a lot of undocumented abortions because these women don't know where to get access to proper abortion because there are just so many legal requirements that come with it. So what tends to happen is women are continued to put in danger because they're turning into alternative ways of aborting their unwanted pregnancies. So it's quite sad, and it's actually happening in Indonesia.
Yeah, and actually there's one NGO in some part of Indonesia that offers that service. So they will be giving you like a pill or like pills to terminate your baby. But of course, it's illegal.
Yeah, that's been one of the big kind of game changers in a lot of this context is that it used to be that most abortions were surgical. And now a lot of early abortions, like before 10 weeks, are involved like two pills that will actually like mail you abortion pills, even if it's illegal in your country, because, you know, they're in countries where it's legal and no one is going to get to them.
So what happens in the US, in your view, with your work as a legal historian, whenever there are states in the United States that does not allow abortion?
Well, I mean, it'll probably be what happened before Roe, in the sense, or before 1973, when abortion was illegal, in the sense that people will keep having abortions. And the question will just be whether anyone can really enforce the law, because now people, it's easier to travel, right? Whether that's out of state or out of the country. And you can get abortion pills on the internet. That doesn't mean it'll be easy necessarily or safe necessarily, because people will do things like off-label in ways that wind up messing them up. But I think it'll be kind of like a cat and mouse game almost, right? Where states are going to criminalize abortion. People are going to try to find ways around that. States are going to try to find ways to close those gaps. People are going to try to find ways to widen them. And it'll go back and forth like that, probably indefinitely.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So my best friend's schedule these days became ultra busy because of a very famous case in Texas, which made the news all the way in Indonesia. And so that is one of the things that I keep getting asked about. I don't know why people think I would know. Obviously, I don't. So I decided to bring my best friend who would know better. Can you tell us more about what happened in Texas and why is it that everybody becomes so interested in this news?
Yeah, so Texas passed a law called SB8 that bans abortion at 6 weeks, which is not, to be clear, it's not 6 weeks after you know you're pregnant. It's 6 weeks after you miss your period, which means usually like 2 weeks at the longest that you know you could be pregnant, right? Like after either by missing a period or taking a pregnancy test. What's weird about Texas's law is that most laws in the US that ban abortion or in Indonesia usually use like criminal prohibitions, right? So you violate them, you go to jail, you get fined, whatever. This instead says, no, we're going to actually say people can sue you for money, at least $10,000 US. And then the question is, well, who can sue you? And the answer is, everybody. If you're listening to this and you want to sue someone in Texas, you can do it. You don't need to be American. You need to be in the United States. Don't need to know anyone having the abortion, right? And it's not just the doctor. It's anyone who, quote unquote, aids or abets the person getting the abortion. So like the Uber driver, the friend who knows about the abortion, you know, lots of people like that. And so what makes the Texas law so weird is that it's, you know, it creates this basically like sort of network of bounty hunters, right, who are in this for the money. And the other thing that's weird about it is, and this is really technical and legal, so I won't get into it, but the whole law is designed to make it impossible to challenge in court. And that's worked. So the US Supreme Court has let this law go into effect. So even though abortion is a constitutional right in the United States, it's basically illegal right now in Texas to get an abortion unless you're doing it in the first 2 weeks after you find out you're pregnant. If you guys wanna know about the legal stuff, I can, it's just in the weeds, but that's why it's a big deal. It's this sort of paradox of how abortion is both a constitutional right in the US and yet conservative states have found this way to ban it.
So you were saying about how when you make abortions harder, actually for people who don't have the money, it can be really penalizing for them. And when you criminalize things such as this, it might end up becoming very much an economic issue. I think this is super interesting because usually when people think of abortion, they think of it mainly as a scientific or a moral question, but not really about the money, actually. And when what we see is a lot of times it becomes a huge industry and it becomes a huge question in politics, and it ends up really benefiting people with a lot of money who can escape in some way the law, right? They can find ways around it. They can probably leave that state in order to get the abortion somewhere else. Basically, it benefits mainly people who can afford to benefit from it.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally true.
Another thing is that when you see this, right, when you see Texas having these much more extreme laws, is it, do you think the US will eventually one day outlaw abortion? So will one day Roe v. Wade just be gone?
Yeah, I mean, I think the US is, one thing to be clear, right, is like the US banning the abortion everywhere in the US is different from Roe v. Wade being overturned. So Roe v. Wade being overturned could mean every part of the US gets to make its own decision, which is kind of what's already happening in Australia. Or it could mean the US Supreme Court says, you know, an unborn child or like a fetus in the womb is a person and abortion is unconstitutional everywhere. That's not likely to happen, at least immediately. So the most likely thing will be, if Roe v. Wade is gone, that whether abortion is legal would depend on which state you live in. I think that's very likely. I mean, I think that could happen in 2022, and if not, it'll happen in the next couple of years. And then the question would be what comes next, which I think is really unpredictable, because that's going to be a huge deal politically in the US, because abortion has been legal everywhere for like half a century at this point. Is there going to be that push to change what the Supreme Court is in the United States? You know, I don't think that'll be the end of the story. But if that were to happen, it would mean essentially that, you know, if you live in New York or California, abortion will be just as legal. But if you live, you know, in Alabama or Texas, it'll be completely criminal.
Man, this is getting very grim. So,
yeah, I mean, it's pretty, I mean, I think the thing historically, right, I mean, if you look at this, the thing to sort of remember, and this is true in Indonesia too, is that the bigger like a zoom out you do with abortion law, the more you realize that a lot of it is politics, even when it seems to be courts, and that when it seems to be that courts have sort of resolved things, they really can't, right? Like they can't make decisions for people make sense, and they can't solve political issues. And so I think there's not going to be a sort of end to abortion in the United States that the Supreme Court brings. And that would be true elsewhere too. So, I mean, that's why people in Indonesia are still having abortions, even though the law says they can't. You know, it's never as easy as, you know, one legal entity making the call for everyone.
Can we make the argument on how much abortion is actually, you know, not having access to abortion and having unwanted children is actually impacting the economy as an argument? And I'm also wondering whether these constituents that vote their representatives into office actually have any other interest, perhaps economic interest in abortion being illegal, apart from their own personal religious and moral beliefs.
Yeah, I mean, we have some sense of how abortion affects individuals. There's a group of researchers in San Francisco who did a study called the Turnaway Study that was basically about, you know, what happens to someone if they want to get an abortion and they can't. What happens to that person? What happens to, you know, if they actually have the child, what happens to the child? Basically that it had an adverse outcome on the person's job prospects, on their financial security, on their likelihood to fall below the poverty line. And that held true for their children too. It's also true in the US, I don't know if it's true in Indonesia, but in the US, most people who have abortions have children already. So it's not a sort of not wanting to be a mom thing for most people. It's often about money, right? It's about people who often disproportionately in the US, people who are having abortions are low income, and they're often people of color. So they're often people dealing with stuff you know, they don't have income for their families, maybe dealing with racism, like their lives are hard. And so often if they're having abortions, it's partially because, you know, society is not doing enough for them anyway. In terms of, you know, why do people vote for abortion laws? I mean, certainly there are a lot of people who profit from abortion being illegal. There are a lot of, you know, interest groups and politicians who profit from that. I don't think most ordinary voters do in the US. There's increasingly voting is dictated by this thing called negative partisanship, which I think exists in Asia too, and it's really messed up. Basically, the idea of negative partisanship is that you vote for one person because you hate the other party. And you hate the other party so bad that if your party puts up like a literal, you know, serial killer, like child molester, who's like foaming at the mouth and whatever, and like eating human beings, you're like, that's okay, because it's not the other party. The other party is just completely unacceptable. There are laws in the US that, you know, for example, have no rape or incest exception. That's not popular in a lot of states in the US, but they're not going to vote for the other party anyway, right? So it's not, some of the people have a financial stake, but some of it is just negative partisanship, which is pretty messed up, but pretty widespread, unfortunately.
So you just kind of go with what your side believes in, because it's kind of an overreaching kind of over-encompassing belief?
Yeah, it's like tribalism.
Tribalism. Mm.
If the person's on my team, even if I don't like them, they're better than crossing parties and voting for somebody else. And it's happening everywhere, but in the US, it's particularly bad, which is how you end up, I think, honestly, with Donald Trump, because lots of Republicans who voted for Donald Trump didn't like Donald Trump, but they couldn't bring themselves to vote for a Democrat, right? And I think there are versions of that in a lot of parts of the world, which is sometimes how we end up with, you know, populist leaders, with, you know, leaders we like, but don't feel we can hold accountable. You know, it just gets hard when you don't really feel as an individual voter that you have an alternative.
The issue of abortion is really not clear cut, that everybody has different perspectives. Even if they say, I follow a certain religion, people have different ways of defining what they think a certain religious text might mean. So it is very hard to then come up with one legal definition that will satisfy every single person's religious beliefs and personal beliefs. And also to realize that a lot of times the way real people think about it is so different than the way politicians play the game once they are in office. I think these are all just really interesting things to think about.
Yeah, and I think it's the one hopeful thing about it is if you're talking to your friends or to real people about abortion, whether they think it should be legal or not, you're going to hear a lot of interesting, nuanced stuff. Like real people having conversations about abortion will probably make you hopeful. And then if you turn on TV or go on social media and hear people like yelling at each other, you'll get really depressed. So the thing to take away from that is like, if you were not as plugged into politics, there's more sensible ways of thinking about this that we could probably come up with. And it's good not to lose sight of those and to have conversations with real people like we're having now.
Oh, I love that. That's so true. For a lot of things, you know, when things become stigmatized or it becomes too taboo and you end up not talking about it, you forget that actually the situation usually has a solution and the situation usually has a middle ground. But when we end up not having open conversations and we hide behind it and we just let politicians take the conversation for us, then we don't actually come to a nice middle ground for most people involved.
Yeah, we also demonize people we disagree with.
Yeah.
Which happens a lot on social media. I mean, you'll get people like on, you know, coming to you and being like, you're a this and a that. And you're like, excuse me, do I know you? Like, if you actually talk to those people, they may not really see you that way.
Right.
And I think that's part of it too. Talking to people is finding a middle ground, but it's also having the empathy to actually hear the person and see if what they're saying in part may or may not make sense to you.
I love that. Definitely. So if there's one thing we can learn really from here is that untuk semua, get used to thinking about things from a different perspective by having empathy and simply listening to other people's stories. Nggak usah diinterrupt dulu, nggak usah dibilang bahwa dia itu salah, but really just listen to people's real life stories, because that is how we can have nuanced conversations about things. Thank you so much, Mary. Actually, I also want to ask the other Taboo Tuesday ladies, apa sih pendapat kalian tentang aborsi? Andrea?
Ooh, speaking of tadi, just listening to people's stories, kayak, I believe we all have the right to have a choice in this matter. because again, it's our body. And also sometimes it's just unplanned. Like maybe you're not raped. Maybe you've done everything you could to prevent pregnancy, tapi masih kebobolan juga. And if we don't have that option when we know we're not ready to have a children, to have a child, I think it's very important to give sex education at schools because nyatanya dilarang agama atau enggak, whether you get married or not, people will keep fucking like bunnies. So why don't we educate them about safe sex, including contraception methods, contraceptive methods, and STIs, instead of banning abortion, getting married at a very young age when they're not emotionally, mentally, financially ready.
Just because you're married doesn't mean you're ready to have a kid. And then perhaps you do plan to conceive. What happens when congenital disorder, and then maybe you don't have a supportive partner or family? What do you do about it if we don't have a choice? I'm neither encouraging abortion as the first option nor glorifying premarital sex. Yeah, it's important for us to talk about this.
So my own personal views, I've always been aware that no contraception is 100% effective in preventing unplanned pregnancies. And I even thought, because I grew up in New Zealand, right? And it's legal over there. And it's very accessible. And when I moved back to Indonesia in 2013, I even thought to myself, if in the off chance I would have to abort a pregnancy, I would fly to New Zealand, which would take 11 hours, but I would do it. And like what Mary said, it's because I am privileged to have that ability to seek it in every way I could, because I know how important it is for me to have a choice and to kind of have the autonomy to choose timing. Like, yeah, of course I personally would like to have a child one day, but there are other things that are more, I am prioritizing more at this time. Finding the right partner, the husband that I would settle down with, like these things take time, and oftentimes timing doesn't correctly fall into place. And having to carry the baby to term, or in some cases, Indonesia, having a forced marriage with the person that you had relations with to conceive the baby, that would totally mess up a lot of these plans that women have. Also, highlight what Mary said about the study in San Francisco to show that when women aren't ready to carry children, and they do, it would impact them in their mental health and their job prospects, and also in the way that the kids would be raised up, right? So there's a lot of social and economical issues that could stem from bringing a pregnancy to term in which the mother may not be ready yet. And I also want to acknowledge that it's very different. It's a case-by-case basis in which my personal stance would be to not have one law to just kind of say this is illegal or and things like that, and not allow space for people to figure things out, because life is messy, right?
Yeah, true.
This is a really interesting topic, I think, when we talk about unplanned pregnancies, because I personally have had known a few women in my life who did not choose to abort their babies, and they did so when they did get pregnant at an extremely early age. A lot of times I think there's a lot of social stigma, right, towards like having a child at an early age. And a lot of times when I was younger, I always thought like, why didn't you choose to abort the baby? Because you obviously are too young, you obviously cannot be able to fend for the baby, yada yada yada. So I think what I learned from having these opinions at an early age is that it doesn't really matter what my opinions are, but at the end of the day, these girls should be able to have the freedom of choice, because it is their life, whether they want to give birth to a baby that they plan or unplan, whether they choose to abort the baby, it should be their choice. Nobody else should come in and say, you should not do this or you should not do that. And I think back to what Talita and echoing what she said, there is no one law that should be applied to every single girl on this planet. Because one, everybody's different. And two, they should have access if they need to abort unwanted pregnancies. So, or unplanned pregnancies. So I think bringing up this issue is very important, especially to all of our listeners out there. Because sometimes we think the way that we do things is the right way. And we have a lot of bias around that. And we think, oh, people should support abortion laws. Oh, people should do not support abortion laws. Like, there's so much noise and so much chatter about all of these issues, which is, yes, it's important to talk about all of this because at the end of the day, women should be able to choose for themselves whether they want to give birth or they don't want to give birth. So yeah, that's my opinion towards abortion. And I hope that through this podcast, by bringing in an expert on abortion laws, we can understand what really drives the decision to create or ban or to approve certain laws. And it's very important for us as women to educate ourselves about what kind of policies are set in place, because all of these policies does affect our life. Contohnya, kalau misalnya di Indonesia kita ada RUPS yang tidak mengizinkan kita mendapatkan aborsi, you won't have access to literally any kind of abortion facilities, right? And you can end up in extremely bad situation, or at the same time, you can end up in very good situations, I don't know. But at the end of the day, we need to re-educate our younger generation. We need to educate the generation of women. Even if they're old, they're young, everybody needs to pay attention.
Thank you so much.
A lot of this makes me think too, there's a concept that's coming up internationally called reproductive justice. And it reminds me, one of the books I'm working on, there's a woman I know who does reproductive justice advocacy, and her sister got pregnant at 16 and decided to have the baby, and she was Black. And one of the things that it struck this woman was not she supported her sister's choice, but that no matter what choice her sister made, people were going to act as if it was wrong, right? So when she had the baby, people were like, oh, you're a teen mom, that's wrong. If she'd had the abortion, people would have said, oh, you had the abortion, that's wrong. And so I think what everybody's been saying about choice is what's really important is that that means not just giving people choice if you're a woman, but like respecting what people actually do and supporting it, which is much harder. It's something that people don't get enough. And that story always stuck with me because the person I was doing the interview with said, even if you have freedom, freedom isn't free, right? Somebody has to help you. And that's something that we could all do better at.
And there's like always a social stigma to whatever choice you made. Because I mean, a lot of like the girls that I actually know had their babies when they were 17, 16 years old. And 10 years down the road, they were still extremely successful. They overcome a lot of challenges in life. But people still stigmatize them as like, oh, but yeah. Despite how successful you are, you got pregnant when you were 16 and you're... baby doesn't have a father.
Yeah, and society often like judges you and assumes that if you have an abortion, you would regret it. Not all women would regret it. That would probably the best and wisest decision they could ever make at that point in their lives.
Sebenarnya untuk diriku sendiri, aku tidak mau aborsi. Me personally. Tetapi aku tahu bahwa valuesku, personal valuesku tidak bisa disamakan dengan personal values orang lain, karena aku bukan punya hidup dia. Hidup dia itu adalah hidup dia. Artinya, tidak bisa kita membuat sebuah pasal atau sebuah peraturan yang hanya memberikan emphasis untuk satu tipe value. Kalau ada namanya aborsi, menurutku kalau ada option-option yang safer, yang aman, yang healthy, dan yang bisa membantu perempuan di saat mereka menghadapi ini, menurutku itu lebih baik. Karena sering hal kita melihat ini hanya sebagai masalah dari sisi moral atau dari sisi agama, tetapi kita tidak melihatnya dari sisi ekonomi, kita tidak melihatnya dari sisi bagaimana kalau kamu itu adalah dari background yang kamu memang benar-benar saat ini tidak bisa memberikan kehidupan yang layak.
Or if you have an abusive partner.
Atau punya abusive partner, dan kalau kita tidak mencoba dengarkan sisi lain, kita nanti akan terbiasa untuk, seperti Mary bilang, demonize orang yang posisinya tidak kita setujui, gitu. Jadi, I think daripada kita nuding-nuding orang, terus bilang, ih, masa kamu waktu itu pregnant, masa kamu ini, cobalah kita mendengarkan cerita orang, nggak usah kudu pakai judgment dulu, tetapi lebih dengan empati.
And what I usually don't agree with pro-lifers is, apa ya, because mereka tuh suka bilang kayak, no, don't get an abortion, just deliver the baby and then put it up for adoption or just put them up orphanage, for example. No, that could be an irresponsible act because, yeah, what happens afterwards? Do you not care about the quality of their lives?
Mm.
What if they're abused at a foster home or something?
So Roe v. Wade was, there's a real woman who was Roe, whose name was Norma McCorvey. And the strange irony was that she never actually had an abortion. By the time her case was done, she had actually given birth. And she gave up all three of her children for adoption. And the book is about what happened to them. And one of the haunting things in the book was how hard it was on her children and how hard it was on her that she had given them up for adoption. And that doesn't mean it's the wrong thing, but it's always messy, right? So saying to someone, oh, hey, abortion is bad and adoption is good, or adoption is bad and abortion is good, it's really going to depend on the individual.
Yeah.
And that story is really, you know, living your life knowing, you know, your mother didn't want you. Or for Norma McCorvey, you know, she would say she could never really go to playgrounds for the rest of her life because it would make her think of the kids she gave up for adoption. So it was certainly hard and complicated for any number of people.
Mary, do you have any last words of wisdom for us as we try to learn more about this issue?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of great resources if people want sort of basic information on abortion. The Guttmacher Institute, which is tied to Planned Parenthood, has a lot of sort of fact sheets and information on abortion in the U.S., and throughout the world. You can follow me on Twitter. I tweet a lot about this. I'm at Mary R. Ziegler on Twitter. But I think there are lots of great international resources, and this is very much a global issue. So I would encourage people to think of it that way, even if what they're focusing on is what's going on in Indonesia or in their own country.
All right, great. Anyway, thank you so much, Mary, for being here. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to Taboo Tuesday. As always, yang penting, you have to unlearn, learn, dan jangan lupa empower. All right, see you all soon. Bye.
Bye, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mary, for your time.
Bye.